Last week, this is Parshas Chayesara. Last week, we lost a leading member of the, I would call it the first generation of national religious rabbis, Rabbi Yisrael Rosen, who was a very important figure in the national religious landscape, in the rabbinic landscape in Israel in general, responsible primarily for the founding of Tzomet Institute to reconcile or to search for solutions, halachic solutions, to allow the use of technology in important contexts, hospitals, army, police, people who are elderly and ill. He also was deeply involved in facilitating halachic conversion for thousands of people, obviously a very urgent and pressing issue in the current state of Israel. This week is Parshas Chayesara, and Am Yisrael is considering the importance of Israel in general, and in particular the first city that was purchased, Hebron, mass assemblies and people convening on Hebron, upon Hebron for Shabbos near the Maris HaMachpelah. So I thought it was appropriate to speak a little bit about Hebron and to quote or to employ a sefer written by Rav Rosen, Zichrono Livracha, in the aftermath of the Yom Kippur War, and of course the aftermath of the war, which was itself in the aftermath of the Six-Day War, and the return of Am Yisrael to the biblical heartland, the hinterland, Hebron, Shechem, Yerushalayim, of course the Shtachim, Yudan, Shamron, Rav Rosen, Zichrono Livracha, wrote a sefer called Atarei Skula, in which he collected Ma'amarei Chazal, Mefarshim on the Torah, about all these cities that had been recovered and liberated during those two events, primarily, of course, the Six-Day War. There was a silent statement, which is evident in his introduction, that we have to experience these cities not just as Israelis and not just militarily, but return to statements of Chazal for a better perspective. I think, if I'm not mistaken, the Sefer had been recently reissued with a slightly different name, Atarei Skula Begova Chazal, which is a very important statement about the current intellectual conversation in Eretz Yisrael, the Torah intellectual conversation. There's a way of studying Tanakh that's called Begova Einayim, in which people are trying to read Tanakh in a way that complements the classic way of reading Tanakh through the prism and the lenses of Chazal and the Mefarshim, but to also read it as a literal text, standalone, independent. What does the text tell us? And many people are familiar with this Tanakh revival, very excited about that revival. Thousands of people convene in Gush on a yearly basis, 10,000 people to study Tanakh, primarily in that fashion. And many of these styles and techniques have made their way across the globe. But of course, it has to be a complementary view, not one which supplants or dislodges Chazal's prism and Chazal's gloss over Tanakh. And that phraseology, Atarei Skula Begova Chazal, which is almost a play on words of Begova Einayim in Hebrew means at eye level, which would mean without looking at a text, or in this case a city, through any prejudicial or prior interpretation, but straight and frontal and direct, Gova Einayim. So the phrase Gova Chazal means to see it specifically through Chazal's lens. So Atarei Skula Begova Chazal means trying to experience these cities. In 1973, 74, when the pamphlet was first published, so looking back to Chazal had one connotation, to be able to return to our homeland through the conduit of our tradition and our Masara. And 40 years later, that had a separate and equally important connotation, not just Begova Einayim, but Begova Chazal. So I thought it'd be appropriate to speak a little bit about Hebron, based on a book which is primarily collecting interesting mamarim, interesting midrashim of Chazal, and creating unexpected associations by juxtaposing midrashim from one location to another that aren't immediately obvious. And of course, a lot of this is my own interpretation of these midrashim that he juxtaposed or associated, but I thought it would be appropriate during Parshas Chayesara, while we're still in the Shiva of Rav Rosen, Zichrono Livracha, so in Le'ilui Nishmaso, to discuss Hebron, the entry point to Gan Eden, which I'm sure he's in now, the entry point through the Torah that he wrote. about 40 years ago, close to now, almost 50 years ago, but 1973, 1974. Hebron has four names, of course: Eshkol, Mamre, Hebron, and Kiryat Arba. And all of these are statements in Midrashim, so I'm not going to necessarily itemize each and every Midrash. But Chazal speak of the four names, and any time, of course, a city has multiple names, it implies multiple dimensions. And I want to speak about three dimensions, which I feel emerge from his 15 pages or so about Hebron. Number one, the most obvious, the one that is the most glaring, the most overt in Parshas Chayesara, is that it was purchased. And it was purchased in a very tedious and painstaking fashion because of Malayat Nanali, very protracted and challenging negotiations, multiple rounds of negotiations. He first has to encounter the Chitim who occupy the periphery, who live in the outer circles, and they pass him along to Ephron, and then he has to re-engage in a second round of negotiations. And because of Malayan, immediately or initially Ephron seems very generous and very eager, and then it becomes very painstaking and litigious. But there's a purchasing of Hebron that's very evident. Why is it purchased, and why does the Torah stress the purchasing? And the truth is, before describing the reason that it's purchased, it's clear, and this is a theme alert throughout the entire shiur, that Hebron and Yerushalayim are twin cities. And in some ways, what happens in Hebron will ultimately affect events, perhaps later, perhaps contemporaneous in Yerushalayim. So Hebron and Yerushalayim are forever twinned. And perhaps the most poetic way of expressing this is the Mishnah in Yoma, which describes the start and the launch of the Avodah in the Beis HaMikdash, in particular on Yom HaKippurim, when they wanted to launch the Avodah as quickly as possible, because it all devolved upon the Kohen Gadol, so it was important to launch the Avodah at the first immediate opportunity. So, according to one opinion, the lookouts would search for the rising sun, and they would only launch the Avodah when the eastern sky had been illuminated all the way until Hebron. Of course, Hebron is south of Yerushalayim, so that wouldn't be the natural way to gauge the onset of day. It would probably be the eastern sky is lit until Yericho. You can see the town of Yericho, which is more or less northeast, but easterly of Yerushalayim, or some other point east of Yerushalayim, and to see if the light has begun to illuminate that city. Now, of course, illuminating a southern city is indicative of more light and a more progressed stage of sunrise, but it's a very poetic way of implying that Avodah can only begin in Yerushalayim once Hebron is illuminated. Heir, kol pnei ha-mizrach ad Hebron. In any event, given that backdrop, it's not surprising that just as Hebron was purchased through very tedious, litigious, difficult negotiations, so was Yerushalayim. David HaMelech had to purchase in particular the Beis HaMikdash from Garan Harnah, or from Harnah. The Garan Harnah is the location he purchased. And Chazal already associate these on various occasions. Very famous Medrash that Yerushalayim and Hebron are two of the three places which were purchased through legal means, full price. And presumably, Hebron, Yerushalayim, and Shechem, which was also purchased, Parshas Vayishlach, presumably these are the three places Chazal say, since we purchased them legally, the nations of the world have absolutely no objection, no right to object. They can't claim that we were invaders or we conquered it, because these were acquired through purely legal terms. As we would say, the I's were dotted, the T's were crossed, and of course, we know that to be unfortunately, we know that to be a foreshadowing and a prophecy that has yet to materialize, and it's specifically these three cities that are under the greatest international objection and most contended for. And that's really the subject of a different shiur. In fact, there's a medrash that suggests that in order to acquire Hebron, Avram had to swear to the Chitim, who would one day become the Yevusim, that he would delay or entirely eliminate, disqualify any attempt to conquer Yerushalayim. It's unclear. Some Midrashim say this was the consequence of Avram's treaty with Avimelech. Some say it was the consequence of Avraham's purchase of Hebron. So, according to the versions, that it was the consequence of the purchase of Hebron, essentially, purchasing Hebron comes at the cost of delaying our entry into Yerushalayim, and I've spoken about this in a link to one other shiur in which I discuss this in the days of David HaMelech and the statues which were erected, a very, very famous but ambiguous section in Shmuel. But why is Hebron and ultimately Yerushalayim, why is it so important for them to be purchased legally with money? How does that alter our experience of these towns and their placement in the landscape of Eretz Yisrael? And I think there are three issues. Number one, the pre-tzaddik, metaphysical or mystical issue, that in order for these areas to achieve a greater stature and a greater level of Kedusha, they have to be acquired at a price, at a cost. That could be articulated in, as I said, and I hinted to metaphysical terms, mystical terms. It could also be at very existential and experiential levels. Everything we acquire at cost through sacrifice is more dear, is more beloved, is more enshrined. So for Yerushalayim and Hebron, and ultimately Shechem, but I want to discuss Yerushalayim and Hebron, to be fully appreciated, and through that appreciation to be treated with sensitivity, with Kedusha, with sanctity, a price has to be paid. Second of all, the fact that it was purchased means that inevitably it wasn't conquered. Conquering land yields allocation, yields chalukah, Yerusha v'chalukah, kibush v'chalukah. Yerushalayim and Hebron were not subjected to conquest, and by extension, were not quote-unquote vulnerable or affected by allocation and distribution. Chazal tell us that Yerushalayim lo nischalka l'shvatim, it remained the province, and it remained the region of an entire nation, rather than being subdivided into the proprietary ownership of a particular shevet. Similarly, Kalev, which was awarded, which was awarded to Kalev, and Yoshua Perek Yudala describes the actual delivery of this land to Kalev as a award for his fidelity and his loyalty during the Chet HaMeraglim. So the purchase is important because it circumvents Yerusha, which is a byproduct of kibush. So if they're conquered, they'll probably be allocated to an entire nation because the entire nation fought for these lands. But if they're purchased, then these lands can be designated as, we would call them national reserves, as national reserves of solidarity, which is obviously crucial for Yerushalayim and ultimately Hebron. Finally, they're purchased rather than conquered because as much as our conquest of Eretz Yisrael is predetermined, divinely ordained, as much as at a cosmological level, as Rashi reminds us in the beginning of the entire Torah, Koach Masav Higid Le'amo, HaKadosh Baruch Hu created the world, he has the right to deliver to whom he chooses, and we possess that divine right. At a human experiential level, conquest is still aggressive. Conquest is still unidirectional, it's not bilateral, it's impositional, it's violent. And these areas, Yerushalayim and by extension Hebron, which are meant to serve as the gateway through which and by which we draw HaKadosh Baruch Hu's presence and disseminate it and broadcast it to an entire world, that broadcast has to flow through cities that ultimately are seated voluntarily. And unfortunately, the legal and voluntary nature by which these cities were acquired is still being contested and disputed because history is still flawed and history is still fractured. But ultimately, at its core, we conquered much of Eretz Yisrael, as HaKadosh Baruch Hu expected us to, and we emptied those lands of the pagan inhabitants. But Yerushalayim and Hebron can't be conquered. Yerushalayim and Hebron have to be mutually, bidirectionally ceded to the Jewish people so they can serve as these conduits through which, as these channels through which HaKadosh Baruch Hu's presence is broadcast by the Jewish people, ideally located or situated on these broadcast booths or on these broadcast stages. So the first aspect of Hebron, and by extension Yerushalayim, which again is probably the most graphic or dramatic in Parshas Chayesara, is the process by which the Jewish presence is established. Unlike other areas of Eretz Yisrael, Hebron and ultimately Yerushalayim have to be purchased. The second aspect, of course, speaks to the actual name of Hebron. The word Hebron, Chazal associates with the word Chaver, that Avram was the first to be buried there. Avram was a Chaver. Avram, one of his nicknames was he was a Chaver. Moshe is a Chaver, one of his nicknames. Chaver, of course, is a friend. And Avram's personality, his chesed, his ability to cast religion as ennobling and enriching to the human condition rather than contradictory. Certainly, the term friendship is a suitable match. His message of religion was not to stifle human experience, but to advance it, as a friend would advance the interests of a friend. But even the word friend etymologically shares another element of that term and ultimately of Hebron, chaver and chibur. And the reason the chaver is referred to as a friend or friend is referred to as a chaver is because of the emotional and interpersonal connections. So the chaver and chaver are etymologically related. What does Hebron connect? Why is it a city of connection? In many ways, in a manner that Yerushalayim is not. The first aspect of Hebron speaks to its method of acquisition, which it shares with Yerushalayim, and it actually foreshadows the acquisitional method of Yerushalayim. But in this respect, Hebron is unique, and Hebron is singular. So the Zohar speaks about Hebron as an opportunity to connect with our legacy, with our fathers, with this is the location where our founding fathers are buried. This is their cemetery. This is their mausoleum. So it allows us to create that connection. And certainly the image of Kalev visiting Hebron, Nishtatech al Kivri Avos, during a time of crisis when he was under duress and he wanted to connect to his source of strength, to the Kivri Avos, certainly reflects Hebron as a connector point. More so, Rabbeinu Bache in Parshas Chayesara highlights Hebron's capacity not just to facilitate connection to our own legacy and our own past, but to facilitate the connection to a different world. To put it bluntly, I say this just for dramatic effect, just to draw your attention, Hebron by definition is a city of death. Namely, it's a city which is pivoted around a cemetery, which is pivoted around the Maris Machpelah. There is no meaning or even dimension to Hebron if it's absent of Maris Machpelah. And that's enunciated very clearly in Parshas Chayesara. Hasadeh v'hamera sherbo. Avram purchases the land, but the land can only be purchased if it contains the me'ara sherbo, the cave, which is incorporated in the land. And to a degree, this is the function of Hebron that Yerushalayim can't play. Yerushalayim, because it's the Makom HaMikdash, because it's the site of Avodah, because it's the site of Tahara, because Yerushalayim is called Machane Leviya, in which you can only enter if you're Tahar, it can't serve as Hebron. It can't serve as an access point to connect or to associate to your past or to the next world through a tombstone, or through a mausoleum, or to a celebrated cemetery. Hebron has to complement that role which Yerushalayim can't play. And this is why Chazal, certainly Kabbalah, tells us that Maris Machpelah is the entryway to the next world, the entryway to Gan Eden. This is the place that the Avos desire to be buried in. According to one statement of Chazal, Avraham actually travels to Maris Machpelah chasing one of the cows that he wanted to slaughter and prepare as food for the Malachim, and then sees the regality of Adam's mausoleum and covets to be buried there next to Adam. So Hebron becomes a gateway. We live in this world. We want to embrace this world. We want to sanctify this world. We want to draw HaKadosh Baruch Hu Shechina into this world. But we also need both a reminder and an access point to our past, and a reminder and an access point to the other world that our past has now transitioned into, that our avos now are part of. And we live in those two worlds, and at some point, that bridge has to be the bridge to our past, And those people who are now in a different world, by definition, have expired, have deceased. They're no longer in our world. So Chevron / the shell of Maris HaMachpelah is a crucial connecting bridge to past that are deceased from our world that are in Gan Eden in a way that Yerushalayim can't facilitate. And that's really the second element of Chevron, the chibur, the connection. If Yerushalayim is ki'ir shachurbu la yachdav shekol Yisrael nasa chaverim, it creates fraternity and solidarity among the living. Chevron creates not kol Yisrael nasa la chaverim, but Chevron, in a way that Yerushalayim cannot, creates integration with a past that's no longer living in this realm, but living in a different realm that's very much alive to us. And that's why all the moments in which our avos are asked to intercede for the Jewish people, and this is enshrined in our slichos, kumu yishenei machpel, Yirmiyah visits kivrei avos, and it all centers around Maris HaMachpelah, not the avos in theory in Shemayim, but the avos in Maris HaMachpelah being asked to intercede in the events of this world, from their world, which is bridged by Maris HaMachpelah and Chevron. So that's really the second element of Chevron, from the word chibur. So the first element is Chevron as a city that has to be purchased in a way that foreshadows Yerushalayim's purchase. It has to be purchased for three reasons: to create the effect of a price and a sacrifice. Number two, to create a land that doesn't get subdivided or parsed out to different tribes, but remains integrated and a symbol of solidarity and fraternity. And finally, a city which is bilaterally, volitionally ceded through legal manner, even though the legal manner of acquisition is still very much under protest. The second element of Chevron is a city that connects us to past and connects us to a world in which our past currently inhabits. The third aspect of Chevron, which is in many ways to me the least known but in some ways the most intriguing, is that Chevron serves as a location, or let's say a pedestal for Jewish monarchy, in a way that complements the monarchy and the royalty and the throne, so to speak, of Yerushalayim. But to understand this, I have to take a step back. At the core of Judaism is the unwillingness to sever politics from religion. Many people believe today that church and state in Israel, so to speak, should be divided, should be separated. And at a tactical level, it may be wise. There may be some very, very awkward and almost insurmountable predicaments and dilemmas caused by the union between the two. On the one hand, we want to infuse the state with a religious nature. On the other hand, politicalization of that religious ambition can sometimes create some very perverted and even not just perverted, but just very contentious issues. Maybe perverted was a poor word. So on the one hand, the ultimate seat of Jewish monarchy has to be tethered to religion and the locus or the epicenter of religion. On the other hand, politics and establishing forms of governance and systems of governance has to start and be launched by human beings. It can't be imposed by a Kadosh Baruch Hu, and that's why the entire solicitation of a king is initiated by human beings when they approach Shmuel. And again, part of it is HaKadosh Baruch Hu doesn't desire a melech because he doesn't want an intermediary. He wants the direct access, and here's our melech. But part of it is HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants human beings. He provides political instinct, but he wants human beings to adopt that instinct and develop and carve political opportunities, political systems to govern, to impose justice, protecting the rights of the innocent, to create civil societies. So there's a dilemma. On the one hand, Jewish politics and government has to be tethered to Yerushalayim. On the other hand, if that's the seed of Malchus, then it's completely supernatural and completely divinely imposed, and the human initiative is eliminated. And this is precisely the role that Chevron plays. Chevron is the location where human beings and Jews independently launch political initiatives, political projects, which culminate and blossom ultimately in Yerushalayim. And of course, the clearest manifestation of this process occurs when our Malchus, our ultimate Malchus, is launched. David begins in Hebron. He inquires of HaKadosh Baruch Hu through the Urim V'Tumim where to begin his monarchy, where to begin that entire process, Shmuel Beis, Perak Beis. The Urim V'Tumim responds, Hebronah. He actually reigns 7 years in Hebron before he ascends to Yerushalayim. But that role of Hebron doesn't end with David's first 7 years. Avner, who is the vestige of Shaul's rivalry monarchy, Avner is killed by Yoav ben Tzruya, David's general, in Hebron. So Avner was still challenging David's right to rule. He was questioning whether Shaul's monarchy should extend based on, as the Gemara says, his own inner conviction. He wasn't a rebel. He just misinterpreted certain psukim. He still believed that Ishbosheth should be the king. And David's Malchus isn't just launched from Hebron, but is consolidated, even when he's in Yerushalayim, by events that take place in Hebron. And then later on, when Avshalom, his son, wants to rebel against his father David, he believes that he can most successfully launch his rebellion and launch his monarchy from Hebron. So he gathers in Hebron. So at the core, at that one moment in time when Jewish monarchy is becoming distilled or crystallizing, coalescing around David, all the events surrounding the launch and the consolidation of Jewish monarchy occur in Hebron. But the truth is, Hebron's role in launching Jewish monarchy predates this very crucial historical period. Kalev travels to Hebron. Kalev is awarded Hebron, Yoshua Perek Yudalit. Who is Kalev? Chazal tell us that Kalev marries Moshe's sister Miriam. So Kalev and Moshe are brothers-in-law. Miriam is awarded Batim. According to one position, the Batim that Miriam is are awarded is Jewish monarchy. David becomes a descendant of Kalev and Miriam, based on the fact that Chazal assumed that Miriam's nickname was Ephrat because she was healed, and David is called Ish Ephrati, so that's how Chazal traced David back to Kalev and Miriam. So imagine this, at some point Kalev, David's great-great-great-grandfather, actually arrives in Hebron hundreds of years. Not clear whether Miriam survives the Dor HaMidbar, she arrives as well, but certainly David's great-great-grandfather Kalev arrives in Hebron, which becomes uniquely his, so that his great-great-great-grandson David can launch monarchy from this location. But it predates Kalev. Yosef dreams of monarchy, and I'll mention specifically the role of Yosef in a few moments, in Hebron. The events of Vayeshev appear to occur in Hebron. Yosef travels from Emek Hebron to the region of Shechem looking for his brothers, and then, of course, is kidnapped and sold to Egypt. So Yosef's dreams that launched Jewish monarchy and Yehuda's presumed opposition, the budding rivalry over the monarchy, takes place in Hebron. But Hebron's role in launching Jewish monarchy even predates Kalev and predates Yosef. Remember, Avram is living in Mamre when he's called to battle the four kings, when he's called to encounter Malkit Tzedek. That event occurs after the battle with the four kings in Yerushalayim. Mamre is one of the nicknames of Hebron. So imagine that Avraham travels from Hebron to encounter the ultimate location of Jewish monarchy, Yerushalayim, where currently there is a temporary sovereign named Malkit Tzedek, and their interaction requires an entirely different elaboration. The promise to Avram with a name change, Umelachim Mechalatzecha Mimcha Yetzeu, that occurs when Avram presumably is living in Mamre, Hebron, or the Hebron area. So from the days of Avram through the days of Yosef, through the period of Kalev, and ultimately when Jewish monarchy crystallizes, Hebron becomes the location where guarantees of monarchy are delivered, dreams of monarchy are dreamt, monarchical or royal ambitions are reinforced by dedication to Hebron and ultimate acquisition of Hebron by Kalev, or not acquisition, but receipt of Hebron delivery of Chevron to Kalev, and then ultimately David HaMelech materializes all this potential by launching the Malchus and reigning in Chevron for 7 years. It's because human beings have to launch monarchy outside of the overwhelming shadow of HaKadosh Baruch Hu's Kisei HaKavod. HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants human beings to devise governance, to infuse and impose justice, civility, rule of law into their world, and then to crown it with HaKadosh Baruch Hu's presence. So there needs to be a city. There needs to be a Petri dish. Yerushalayim can't serve as the Petri dish for monarchy. In the specter, the shadow of the Kisei HaKavod, human beings have no initiative, no creativity. It's all humbled and pulverized by the presence of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So Chevron creates this social experiment, this laboratory for human beings to try to cobble together their forms of governance, and then that government relocates to Yerushalayim, and it is embraced and incorporated into divine monarchy. This is specifically why Yosef has his dreams. Yosef, Mashiach ben Yosef, is the pre-monarchy to Yehuda's ultimate. And that's ultimately Yosef's role is very similar structurally to Chevron's role. Mashiach ben Yosef is engaged in the wars, the politics of the end of days, the struggle to close the end of days, to vanquish evil, to introduce the presence of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And so to speak, Yehuda is the beneficiary. I'm just painting it in very, very generalized terms, but Malchus Yehuda arrives at the tail end of that process once all opposition and all adversaries have been quieted and stilled. So Yosef dreams in Chevron about his role that can only be realized in Chevron as the launching pad for human initiatives towards Malchus that then yield heavenly Malchus. So those are the three aspects of Chevron that I felt emerged from Rev Rosen Zichrono Levracha's collection of different statements of Chazal. Number one, Chevron has to be purchased for various reasons. Number two, Chevron is a city of connection, but not connection amongst the living, but connection to a different realm occupied or inhabited by our past. And finally, Chevron is the seat of Malchus, but not the ultimate seat of Malchus, the seat of Malchus that yields or facilitates a divine Malchus in Yerushalayim.